Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 106th of the Cthulhu Podcast. I'm FNH. Today we only have two segments. The next part are Through the Brazilian Wilderness by Teddy Roosevelt, and then on to part two of our feature story. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 63. On the morning of March 22nd, we started in our six canoes. We made 10 kilometres. 20 minutes after starting, we came to the first rapids. Here everyone walked except the three best paddlers, who took the canoes down in succession, an hour's job. Soon after this, we struck a bee's nest in the top of a tree overhanging the river. Our steersman climbed out and robbed it, but, alas, lost the honey on the way back. We came to a small, steep fall, which we did not dare run in our overladen, clumsy and cranky dugouts. Fortunately, we were able to follow a deep canal which led off for a kilometre, returning just below the falls 50 yards from where it started. Then, having been in the boats and in motion for only an hour and a half, we came to a long stretch of rapids, which it took us 6 hours to descend, and we camped at the foot. Everything was taken out of the canoes, and they were run down in succession. At one difficult and perilous place, they were let down on ropes, and even thus we almost lost one. We went down on the right bank. On the opposite bank was an Indian village, evidently inhabited only during the dry season. The marks on the stumps of trees showed that these Indians had axes and knives, and there were old fields in which maize, beans and cotton had been grown. The forest dripped and steamed. Rubber trees were plentiful. At one point, the tops of a group of tall trees were covered with yellow-white blossoms. Others bore red blossoms. Many of the big trees of different kinds were buttressed at the base with great thin walls of wood. Others, including both palms and ordinary trees, showed an even stranger peculiarity. The trunk near the base, but sometimes 6 or 8 feet from the ground, was split into a dozen or 20 branches or small trunks, which sloped outward in a tent-like shape, each becoming a root. The larger trees of this type looked as if their trunks were seated on the tops of the pole frames of Indian teepees. At one point in the stream, to our great surprise, we saw a flying fish. It skimmed the water like a swallow for over 20 yards. Although we made only 10 kilometres, we worked hard all day. The last canoes were brought down and moored to the bank at nightfall. Our tents were pitched in the darkness. Next day we made 13 kilometres. We ran, all told, a little over an hour and 3/4. 7 hours were spent in getting past a series of rapids, at which the portage over rocks and difficult ground was a kilometre long. The canoes were run down empty, a hazardous run in which one of them was upset. Yet while we were actually on the river, paddling and floating downstream along the reaches of swift, smooth water, it was very lovely. When we started in the morning, the day was overcast and the air was heavy with vapour. Ahead of us, the shrouded river stretched between dim walls of forest, half seen in the mist. Then the sun burned up the fog, and loomed through it in a red splendour that changed first to gold and then to molten white. In the dazzling light under the brilliant blue of the sky, every detail of the magnificent forest was vivid to the eye. The great trees, the network of bush ropes, the caverns of greenery where thick-leaved vines covered all things. Wherever there was a hidden boulder, the surface of the current was broken by waves. In one place, in midstream, a pyramidal rock thrust itself 6 feet above the surface of the river. On the banks we found fresh Indian sign. At home in Vermont, Cherry is a farmer, with a farm of 600 acres, most of it woodland. As we sat at the foot of the rapids watching the last dugouts with their naked paddlers to swing into the sight round the bend through the white water, we talked of the northern spring that was just beginning. He sells cream, eggs, poultry, potatoes, honey, occasionally pork and veal. But at this season, it was the time for the maple sugar crop. He has a sugar orchard where he taps 1,200 trees and hopes soon to tap as many more in addition. Said Cherry, "It's a busy time now for Fred Rice." Fred Rice is the hired man, and in sugar time the Cherry boys help him with enthusiasm, and moreover are paid with exact justice for the work they do. There is much wildlife about the farm, although it is near Brattleboro. One night in early spring a bear left his tracks near the sugar house, and now and then in summer Cherry's had to sleep in the garden to keep the deer away from the beans, cabbages and beets. There was not much bird life in the forest, but Cherry kept getting species new to the collection. At this camp he shot an interesting little ant thrush. It was the size of a warbler, jet black, with white undersurfaces of the wings and tail, white on the tail feathers and a large spot of white on the back, normally almost concealed, the feathers on the back being long and fluffy. When he shot the bird, a male, it was showing off before a dull-coloured little bird, doubtless the female, and the chief feature of the display was that this white spot on the back was displayed. The white feathers were raised and displayed so that the spot flashed like the chrysanthemum on a prongbok whose curiosity has been aroused. In the gloom of the forest the bird was hard to see, but the flashing of this patch of white feathers revealed it at once, attracting immediate attention. It was an excellent example of a coloration mark which served as a purely advertising purpose. Apparently it was part of a courtship display. The bird was about 30 feet up in the branches. In the morning, just before leaving this camp, a tapir swam across the stream a little way above us, but unfortunately we could not get much of a shot at it. An ample supply of tapir beef would have meant much to us. We had started with 50 days' rations, but this by no means meant full rations, in the sense of giving every man all he wanted to eat. We had 2 meals a day, and were on rather short commons, both our mess and our camaradas, except when we got plenty of palm tops. For our mess we had the boxes chosen by Fiala, each containing a day's rations for 6 men, our number, but we made each box last a day and a half, or at times 2 days. And in addition we gave some of the food to the camaradas. It was only on the rare occasions when we had killed some monkeys or curacaos, or caught some fish, that everybody had enough. We would have welcomed that tapir. So far the game, fish and fruit had been too scarce to be an element of weight in our food supply. In an exploring trip like ours, through a difficult and utterly unknown country, especially if densely forested, there is little time to make a halt, and game cannot be counted on. It is only in lands like our own West 30 years ago, like South Africa in the middle of the last century, like East Africa today, that game can be made the chief food supply. On this trip, our only substantial food supply from the country hitherto had been that furnished by the palm tops. 2 men were detailed every day to cut down palms for food. And now on to today's main feature, which is part 2 of The Black Stone by Robert E. Howard, part 2. It was while returning from a visit with this schoolmaster one night, about a week after my arrival at Stredukevar, that I had a sudden recollection which struck me. It was Midsummer's night, the very time that the legends linked with grisly implications to the Black Stone. I turned away from the tavern and strode swiftly through the village. Stregiokovar lay silent, the villagers retired early. I saw no one, and I passed rapidly out of the village and up into the firs which masked the mountain slopes with whispering darkness. A broad silver moon hung above the valley, flooding the crags and slopes in a weird light, and etching the shadows blackly. No wind blew through the firs, but a mysterious intangible rustling and whispering was abroad. Surely on such nights in past centuries, my whimsical imagination told me, naked witches astride magic broomsticks had flown across the valley, pursued by jeering demonic familiars. I came to the cliffs, and was somewhat disquieted to note that the elusive moonlight lent them a subtle appearance I had not noticed before. In the weird light they appeared less like natural cliffs, and more like the ruins of cyclopean and titan-reared battlements jutting up from the mountain slope. Shaking off this hallucination with difficulty, I came upon the plateau, and hesitated a moment before I plunged into the brooding darkness of the woods. A sort of breathless tenseness hung over the shadows, like an unseen monster holding its breath, lest it scare away its prey. I shook off the sensation, a natural one, considering the eeriness of the place and its evil reputation, and made my way through the wood, experiencing a most unpleasant sensation that I was being followed, and halting once, sure that something clammy and unstable had brushed against my face in the darkness. I came out into the glade and saw the tall monolith rearing its gaunt height above the sward. At the edge of the woods, on the side towards the cliffs, was a stone which formed a sort of natural seat. I sat down, reflecting that it was probably while there that the mad poet Justin Jeffrey had written his fantastic People of the Monolith. Mine host thought that it was the stone which had caused Jeffrey's insanity, but the seeds of madness had been sown in the poet's brain long before he ever came to Streggyokovar. A glance at my watch showed that the hour of midnight was close at hand. I leaned back, waiting whatever ghostly demonstration might appear. A thin night wind started up among the branches of the firs, with an uncanny suggestion of faint unseen pipes whispering an eerie and evil tune. The monotony of the sound and my steady gazing at the monolith produced a sort of self-hypnosis upon me. I grew drowsy. I fought this feeling, but sleep stole in on me despite myself. The monolith seemed to sway and dance, strangely distorted to my gaze. And then I slept. I opened my eyes and sought to rise, but lay still, as if an icy hand gripped me helpless. Cold terror stole over me. The glade was no longer deserted. It was thronged by a silent crowd of strange people, and my distended eyes took in strange barbaric details of costume which my reason told me were archaic and forgotten even in this backward land. Surely, I thought, these are the villagers who have come here to hold some fantastic conclave. But another glance told me that these people were not the folk of Streggyokovar. They were shorter, more squat race, whose brows were lower, whose faces were broader and duller. Some had Slavic and Magyar features, but those features were degraded as from a mixture of some baser alien strain that I could not classify. Many wore the hides of wild beasts, and their whole appearance, both men and women, was one of sensual brutishness. They terrified and repelled me, but they gave me no heed. They formed in a vast half-circle in front of the monolith and began a sort of chant, flinging their arms in unison and weaving their bodies rhythmically around from the waist upward. All eyes were fixed on the top of the stone which they seemed to be invoking. But the strangest of all was the dimness of their voices. Not 50 yards from me, hundreds of men and women were unmistakably lifting their voices in a wild chant, yet those voices came to me as a faint, indistinguishable murmur, as if from across vast leagues of space, or time. Before the monolith stood a sort of brazier, from which a vile, nauseous yellow smoke billowed upwards, curling curiously in a swaying spiral around the black shaft, like a vast, unstable snake. On one side of the brazier lay two figures, a young girl, stark naked, and bound hand and foot, and an infant, apparently only a few months old. On the other side squatted a hideous old hag with a queer sort of drum on her lap. This drum she beat with a slow, light blow of her open palm, but I could not hear the sound. The rhythm of the swaying bodies grew faster, and into the space between the people and the monolith sprang a naked young woman, her eyes blazing, her long black hair flying loose. Spinning dizzily on her toes, she whirled across the open space and fell prostrate before the stone where she lay motionless. The next instant, a fantastic figure followed her, a man from whose waist hung a goatskin, and whose features were entirely hidden by a sort of mask made from a huge wolf's head, so that he looked like a monstrous nightmare being, horribly compounded of elements both human and bestial. In his hand he held a bunch of long fur switches bound together at the larger ends, and the moonlight glinted on a chain of heavy gold looped about his neck. A smaller chain, depending from it, suggested a pendant of some sort, but this was missing. The people tossed their arms violently and seemed to redouble their shouts as this grotesque creature loped across the open space with many a fantastic leap and caper. Coming to the woman who lay before the monolith, he began to lash her with the switches he bore, and she leaped up and spun into the wild mazes of the most incredible dance I have ever seen. And her tormentor, he danced with her, keeping the wild rhythm, matching her every whirl and bound, while incessantly raining cruel blows on her naked body. And at every blow he shouted a single word, over and over, and all the people shouted it back. I could see the working of their lips, and now the faint, far-off murmur of their voices merged and blended into one distant shout, repeated over and over with slobbering ecstasy. But what the one word was I could not make out. In dizzy whirls spun the wild dancers, while the lookers-on, standing still in their tracks, followed the rhythm of their dance with swaying bodies and weaving arms. Madness grew in the eyes of the capering votaress, and was reflected in the eyes of the watchers. Wilder and more extravagant grew the whirling frenzy of that mad dance. It became a bestial and obscene thing, while the old hag howled and battered the drum like a crazy woman, and the switches cracked out a devil's tune. Blood trickled down the dancer's limbs, but she seemed not to feel the lashing save as a stimulus for further enormities of outrageous motion, bounding into the midst of the yellow smoke, which now spread out tenuous tentacles to embrace both flying figures. She seemed to merge with that foul fog and veil herself with it. Then, emerging into plain view, closely followed by the beast-thing that flogged her, she shot into an indescribable explosive burst of dynamic mad motion, and on the very crest of that mad wave, she dropped suddenly to the sward, quivering and panting as if completely overcome by her frenzied exertions. The lashing continued with unabated violence and intensity, and she began to wiggle towards the monolith on her belly. The priest, or such I will call him, followed, lashing her unprotected body with all the power of his arm as she writhed along, leaving a heavy track of blood on the trampled earth. She reached the monolith, and grasping and panting, flung both arms about it, and covered the cold stone with fierce hot kisses, as if in frenzied and unholy adoration. The fantastic priest bounded high in the air, flinging away the red-dabbled switches, and the worshippers, howling and foaming at the mouths, turned on each other with tooth and nail, rending one another's garments and flesh in a blind passion of bestiality. The priest swept up the infant with a long arm, and shouting again that name, whirled the wailing babe high in the air and dashed its brains out against the monolith, leaving a ghastly stain on the black surface. Cold with horror, I saw him rip the tiny body open with his bare brutish fingers and fling handfuls of blood on the shaft, and then toss the red and torn shape into the brazier, extinguishing flame and smoke in a crimson rain, while the maddened brutes behind him howled over and over the name. Then suddenly they all fell prostrate, writhing like snakes while the priest flung wide his gory hands as in triumph. I opened my mouth to scream my horror and loathing, but only a dry rattle sounded. A huge, monstrous, toad-like thing squatted on top of the monolith. I saw its bloated, repulsive, and unstable outline against the moonlight, and set in what would have been the face of a natural creature, his huge blinking eyes which reflected all the lust, abysmal greed, obscene cruelty, and monstrous evil that has ever stalked the sons of men since their ancestors moved blind and hairless in the treetops. In those grisly eyes were mirrored all the unholy things and vile secrets that sleep in the cities under the sea, and that skulk from the light of day in the blackness of primordial caverns. And so that ghastly thing that the unhallowed ritual of cruelty and sadism and blood had evoked from the silence of the hills leered and blinked down on its bestial worshippers, who grovelled in abhorrent abasement before it. Now the beast-masked priest lifted the bound and weakly writhing girl in his brutish hands, and held her up toward that horror on the monolith. And as the monstrosity sucked in its breath, lustfully and slobberingly, something snapped in my brain, and I fell into a merciful faint. I opened my eyes on a still white dawn. All the events of the night rushed back on me, and I sprang up, then stared about me in amazement. The monolith brooded gaunt and silent above the sward, which waved green and untrampled in the morning breeze. A few quick strides took me across the glade. Here had the dancers leapt and bounded until the ground should have been trampled bare, and here had the votaress wriggled her painful way to the stone, streaming blood on the earth. But no drop of crimson showed on the uncrushed sward. I looked shudderingly at the side of the monolith against which the bestial priest had brained the stolen baby. But no dark stain nor grisly clot showed there. A dream! It had been a wild nightmare. Or else, I shrugged my shoulders. What vivid clarity for a dream! I returned quickly to the village, and entered the inn without being seen. And there I sat meditating over the strange events of the night. More and more was I prone to discard the dream theory. That what I had seen was illusion and without material substance was evident. But I believed that I had looked on the mirrored shadow of a deed perpetrated in ghastly actuality in bygone days. But how was I to know? What proof to show that my vision had been a gathering of foul spectres, rather than a nightmare originating in my brain? As if for answer, a name flashed into my mind. Selim Baradar. According to legend, this man, who had been a soldier as well as a scribe, had commanded that part of Suleiman's army which had devastated Streghiokovar. It seemed logical enough, and if so, he had gone straight from the blotted-out countryside to the bloody field of Shomval and his doom. I sprang up with a sudden shout. That manuscript which was taken from the Turk's body and which Count Boris shuddered over, might it not contain some narration of what conquering Turks found in Streghiokovar? What else could have shaken the iron nerves of the Polish adventurer? And since the bones of the Count had never been recovered, what was more certain than that the lacquered case, with its mysterious contents, still lay hidden beneath the ruins that covered Boris Vladanov? I began packing my bag with fierce haste. 3 days later found me ensconced in a little village a few miles from the old battlefield, and when the moon rose, I was working with savage intensity on the great pile of crumbling stone that crowned the hill. It was back-breaking toil. Looking back now, I cannot see how I accomplished it, though I laboured without a pause from moonrise to dawn. Just as the sun was coming up, I tore aside that last tangle of stones and looked on all that was mortal of Count Boris Vladanov, only a few pitiful fragments of crumbling bone, and among them, crushed out of all original shape, lay a case whose lacquered surface had kept it from complete decay through the centuries. I seized it with frenzied eagerness, and piling back some of the stones on the bones, I hurried away, for I did not care to be discovered by the suspicious peasants in an act of apparent desecration. Back in my tavern chamber, I opened the case and found the parchment comparatively intact. And there was something else in the case, a small squat object wrapped in silk. I was wild to plumb the secrets of those yellowed pages, but weariness forbade me. Since leaving Streghiokovar, I'd hardly slept at all, and the terrific exertions of the previous night combined to overcome me. In spite of myself, I was forced to stretch myself on the bed, nor did I awake until sundown. I snatched a hasty supper, and then, in the light of the flickering candle, I set myself to read the neat Turkish characters that covered the parchment. It was difficult work, for I'm not deeply versed in the language, and the archaic style of the narrative baffled me. But as I toiled through it, a word or a phrase here and there leapt at me, and dimly growing horror shook me in its grip. I bent my energies fiercely to the task, and as the tale grew clearer and took more tangible form, my blood chilled in my veins, my hair stood up, and my tongue clove to my mouth. All external things partook of the grisly madness of that internal manuscript, until the night sounds of insects and creatures in the woods took the form of ghastly murmurings and strangely treadings of ghoulish horrors, and the sighing of the night wind changed to tittering, obscene gloating of evil over the souls of men. At last, when the grey dawn was stealing through the latticed window, I laid down the manuscript, and took up and unwrapped the thing in the bit of silk. Staring at it with haggard eyes, I knew the truth of the matter was clinched, even had it been possible to doubt the veracity of that terrible manuscript. And I replaced both obscene things in the case, nor did I rest, nor sleep, nor eat until that case containing them had been weighted with stones and flung into the deepest current of the Danube, which, God grant, carried them back into the hell from which they came. It was no dream I dreamed on midsummer's midnight in the hills above Streghiokovar. Well for Justin Jeffrey that he tarried there only in the sunlight, and then went his way. for had he gazed upon that ghastly conclave, his mad brain would have snapped before it did. How my own reason held, I do not know. No, it was no dream. I gazed upon a foul rout of votaries long dead, come up from hell to worship as of old, ghosts that bowed before a ghost. For hell has long claimed their hideous god. Long, long he dwelt among the hills, a brain-shattering vestige of an outworn age, but no longer his obscene talons clutch for the souls of living men, and his kingdom is a dead kingdom, peopled by the ghosts of those who served him in his lifetime and theirs. By what foul alchemy or godless sorcery the gates of hell are opened on that one eerie night I do not know, but mine own eyes have seen. And I know I looked on no living thing that night, for the manuscript, written in the careful hand of Selim Baradur, narrated at length what he and his raiders found in the valley of Stregio Cavar. And I read, set down in detail, the blasphemous obscenities that torture wrung from the lips of screaming worshippers. And I read, too, of the lost, grim black cavern high in the hills where the horrified Turks hemmed a monstrous, bloated, wallowing, toad-like being, and slew it with flame and ancient steel blessed in old times by Muhammad, and with incantations that were as old when Arabia was young. And even staunch old Selim's hand shook as he recorded the cataclysmic, earth-shattering death howls of the monstrosity, which died not alone. For half-score of his slayers perished with him, in ways that Selim would not or could not describe. And that squat idol, carved of gold and wrapped in silk, was an image of himself, and Selim tore it from the golden chain that looped about the neck of the slain high priest of the mask. "'Tis well that the Turks swept out that foul valley with torch and cleanly steel. Such sights as those brooding mountains have looked on belong to the darkness and abysses of lost eons. No, it is not fear of the toad thing that makes me shudder in the night. He is made fast in hell with his nauseous horde, freed only for an hour on the most weird night of the year, as I have seen. And of his worshippers, none remains. But it is the realization that such things once crouched beast-like above the souls of men which brings cold sweat to my brow. And I fear to peer again into the leaves of von Juntz's abomination. For now I understand his repeated phrase of keys, aye, keys to the outer doors, links with an abhorrent past and, who knows, of abhorrent spheres of the present. And I understand why the cliffs look like battlements in the moonlight, and why the tavern-keeper's nightmare-haunted nephew saw in his dream that black stone like a spire on a cyclopean black castle. If men ever excavate among those mountains, they may find incredible things below those masking slopes. For the cave wherein the Turks trapped the thing was not truly a cavern, and I shudder to contemplate the gigantic gulf of eons which must stretch between this age and the time when the earth shook herself and reared up like a wave, and those blue mountains that, rising, enveloped unthinkable things. May no man ever seek to uproot that ghastly spire that men call the Black Stone. A key. Aye, it is a key, a symbol of a forgotten horror. That horror has faded into the limbo from which it crawled, loathsomely, in the black dawn of the earth. But what of the other fiendish possibilities hinted at by von Juntz? What of the monstrous hand which strangled out his life? Since reading what Selim Baradur wrote, I can no longer doubt anything in the black book. Man was not always master of the earth, and is he now? And the thought recurs to me. If such a monstrous entity as the master of the monolith somehow survived its own unspeakably distant epoch so long, what nameless shapes may even now lurk in the dark places of the world? So that's it. Except to remind you that the opening music is by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.